healthcare becomes increasingly more limited. Since March 2 in Lebanon, six hospitals have had to shut down their operations for various reasons. Three of those hospitals are located south of the Litani River, where I mentioned tens of thousands of people live. And so increasingly, we're seeing in some places that access to healthcare is being limited, not only by Israeli attacks, but also because strikes on bridges are limiting the abilities of hospital staff to get easy and predictable access to medical supplies that they need. We were in Sur last week, and we spoke with a hospital official at Jabal Amal Hospital, one of the main hospitals in the city. And they've told us that essentially, in order to get supplies after bridges have been struck, they've had to take their own cars, drive across the Litani River, go to the city of Saida, which is several kilometers away, I think approximately 30 kilometers away, get supplies and come back to the hospital, often having to do it at night at great risk to the staff themselves. Paramedic workers have told us that in order to send supplies into the area south of the Litani, they typically wait until injured people are carried into Beirut across the Litani River so that they can send back in those transport vehicle medical supplies that are desperately needed by paramedic staff and other healthcare workers. And so the strikes on medical workers are taking place. We've documented repeated apparently deliberate attacks on these medical workers, but there's also an increasing attacks that are significantly limiting the ability of people to access healthcare in Lebanon. And with the attacks yesterday, I mean, we saw hospitals quickly becoming overwhelmed with people being rushed in as ambulances streamed into them, following the scale of the attacks and the number of injuries, with over 1,000 people injured.
Ramzi Qais, I want to thank you for being with us. Lebanon researcher at Human Rights Watch based in Beirut. Please remain safe yourself. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Up next, we speak with Professor Robert Pape of the University of Chicago. His latest piece headlined, "The War is Turning Iran into a Major World Power." Stay with us.
What emerges through the mud in the garden that you sowed with blood? 'Cause now our streets will own the flood. It's wartime. We lost the chance to stop the flow. So many millions of lives ago.
Farrell Foster, performing at the Brooklyn Folk Festival. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The war is turning Iran into a major world power. That's the headline of a new op-ed in the New York Times by our next guest, Robert Pape, professor of political science at the University of Chicago. Professor Pape writes Iran's control over the Strait of Hormuz could help elevate Iran to become a fourth center of global power, along with the United States, China, and Russia. Pape writes, quote, "If Iranian control over the Strait persists for months or years, as I believe it may, it will drastically reshape the global order to the detriment of the United States," unquote. Professor Pape joins us now from London. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor. Can you lay out your argument, why you believe the war is turning Iran into a major world power?
Yes. Thank you very much for having me. What most people know is that Iran is causing oil shortages through selective blockade using drones and mines. I'm going one step further. I'm discussing the power that selective blockade gives Iran today, in the coming months, and in the coming years. It is power because of geography. The choke point at Hormuz is geographically perfectly located to allow Iran to selectively control the shipping through Hormuz, which means it can use that selective control as leverage to gain political power in the Gulf, change the hierarchy, change the balance of power in the Gulf from a balance to a hierarchy where Iran now is at the top of the hierarchy. And if other states do not accept Iran's power, they lose tremendous gross domestic product. Also in Asia, the power that Iran has to cause the Asian states to distance themselves from the United States is already evident, and that's only going to grow over time because Asia is ground zero for the economic shock effects that Iran can have with its selective blockade. Then on top of that, when you look at the United States, look at how little power the United States has for its basings, with its basing structure in the Persian Gulf. We know the United States has bases in Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, but look how vulnerable those bases are, how much they've actually had to stand down operations, and our own aircraft carriers are 1,000 miles away from the Persian Gulf for fear that they will be hit and sunk. What all this adds up to is growing power of Iran, diminishing power of the United States. And on top of all of that, Amy, over the next months and year, there will be $75-100 billion of oil revenues going into Iran. It's in Chinese banks that can be used to create, transform that nuclear-enriched material into working nuclear weapons. And if we can't destroy the drones in those deep caves, what makes us think we're really going to stop Iran from becoming a nuclear power in the next 6 months or a year? You add all that up, and Iran will become a nuclear weapons oil hegemon in the near future, in the coming months, coming years. That means it will be the fourth center of world power.
You write, it's possible to control the strait without closing it. Explain how that's occurring.
We are watching in real time. Iran is declaring, unless you cooperate with the Iranian military, the Iranian military will sink your ship as it goes through the Strait of Hormuz. And that threat has been made credible over 40 days of actually doing that. Just a few days ago, a Kuwaiti oil tanker tried to run the strait. And what happened? It was hit. The French, for the first time in this war, about 2 days ago, first time that a European tanker got through, that happened as President Macron announced that France would not participate in any military endeavor to wrestle the Strait of Hormuz from Iran and would, in fact, cooperate with Iran. So what you see is cooperation, that is political kowtowing, gets you oil. If you don't do that, you get your ship sunk. And Iran is doing this, has been doing this now for 40 days. So it is a highly credible instrument of power. And Iran is not likely to surrender it. In all my studies, for 35 years, I have never found a state in the last 300 years that has willingly surrendered world power. And that's why the ceasefire is breaking down.
You posted on social media yesterday, quote, power isn't just about what you control. It's about what you can put at risk. In a global economy, risk equals power. Explain.
Yeah, so we have, in political science, international relations, we have all our measures of raw power. We look at gross domestic product, we look at military forces, we look at nuclear weapons. What all of those static indicators are about, Amy, is the ability of a state to threaten other states, to do, in other words, to make other states vulnerable. What you are seeing with Iran is that its geography in combination with a level of drone technology that we simply cannot destroy. We can destroy 50% of it, 70% of it, but Iran, in thanks to the geography of the Straits, only needs a small amount of offensive power, a number of drones, a small number of mines, in order to achieve the mission it must achieve to make the countries vulnerable, which is to sink their ships. This is actually quite similar to the Vietnam War, where the Ho Chi Minh Trail, America, through air power, was able to cut 80-90% of the throughput of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but we could never get the final 10%, and that's why the VC won.
Professor Pape, your Substack page is called The Escalation Trap. What is that?
The escalation trap is when a strong country, the United States, uses military force, air power that can be tactically successful. Bombs hit targets, bombs kill leaders, but it does not produce strategic success. And that looming prospect of defeat for that power that just launched that attack is what drives that state up the escalation ladder to look for a rung that it will find victory. And that's exactly what you see with Donald Trump. Donald Trump started this war with essentially 3-day air plan. Yes, he had some backups, but he was telling us this is going to be over in 3 days. Well, instead of disabling, causing the regime of Iran to collapse, it got stronger. It is now a more vicious, a stronger regime than before. So he launched the air campaign. Well, the air campaign was supposed to weaken Iran, and we did destroy launchers. But what that did is it allowed Iran to lash back in a horizontal escalation that seized the Strait of Hormuz. Now, after 40 days, Iran hasn't just seized the control of the Strait of Hormuz. It's feeling its power, Amy. It is now using its power. It's learning. This isn't just theoretical power capability. This is real power capability. And this, you see this with India. India is effectively cooperating with Iran, bowing to Iran. And that's why a number of Indian oil tankers have been able to get through. In the French, I just mentioned, and over time, this is going to exert enormous power. Iran will exert enormous power over the states in the Persian Gulf. One of the reasons the Saudis and the UAE are so desperate, but where are they going to go for protection? Donald Trump's nowhere has proven his protection isn't worth anything. So over time, you will probably see more and more bandwagoning toward Iran. The alternative for those Gulf states, if they don't bandwagon, is Iran will probably topple their governments.
I want to get your response to Defense Secretary Hegseth speaking after the ceasefire was announced.
Operation Epic Fury was a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield. A capital V military victory.
So I want to get your response to that, especially in light of you writing, imagine Iran with control of about 20% of the world's oil, Russia with about 11%, and China able to soak up much of that supply. They would form a cartel to deny the West 30% of the world's oil. Professor Pape.
Exactly. What you're hearing, Amy, from Secretary Hegseth is a victory narrative, but it's meeting escalation reality. The reality is Iran is far stronger than it was just 40 days ago. It is in control of 20% of the world's oil. It is now an emerging fourth center of power, and the other centers of power are not all competing with each other. The United States is on one side, and the rivals are China, Russia, and now Iran. And even if those three rivals don't form a NATO-like integrated command structure, they will structurally, just because of the nature of the power balance, they will structurally end up tacitly or explicitly working together. And as you just explained in my op-ed, I lay out a very plausible scenario. With Iran's 20% of the world's oil, Russia has 11%. Why exactly are they not going to work together at some point in the near future to cut that, to deny that 30% of the world's oil to Europe, to the West, and essentially let China soak up that oil? This will be tremendous leverage they will wield, and unless we start to recognize that, this may become a reality, because that's 30% of the world's oil is a tremendous amount of pressure, and even America won't be able to escape the consequences of that.
Is there a way out of the escalation trap right now? And can you comment on what's about to take place? You have Vice President Vance headed from Hungary to Islamabad to join with Witkoff and President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to negotiate with Iran.
Well, there are only two ways to settle this. One on the battlefield, that's the escalation trap. The other at the negotiating table. The problem with the negotiating table is that given Iran's surge in power, the price to get Iran to even give up a sliver or half of that power is going up and going up and going up. So the deals that were on offer on February 27th simply are not going to be enough. Iran already wanted its 3.5% enriched uranium on February 27th. Well, notice now it has more power, so it's not going to go back to the old deal. The one card that could be played that would really matter, I believe, get Iran's attention, would be a enforceable military containment of Israel. You see, Iran has said very clearly it wants protection, confidence that it won't be attacked in the future by from both the United States and Israel. Well, you might think the United States has gotten enough of a black eye here. It might back off. Israel's a completely different story, as your previous stories were just laying out. So a true military containment of Israel, possibly even Israel joining the NPT and having to accept that there's on-site inspections in Iran, there'll be on-site inspections of the nuclear facilities, the nuclear and production facilities at Dimona. Now we're talking. But if that's not politically plausible, if we say that's just not ever going to happen, then how else are you really going to get out of the trap? What would you give Iran to surrender world power? I don't think they're going to take a sucker deal at this point.
Robert Pape, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Professor of political science at the University of Chicago, studies how forces used to achieve political objectives. We'll link to your piece in the New York Times, "The War is Turning Iran into a Major World Power." Professor Pape is joining us from London. Up next, what has the Iran war meant for Gulf states that have been on the front lines of the conflict? We'll go to the Gulf to speak with Yasmin Farouk. Stay with us.
I get up in the evening, and I ain't got nothing to say. I come home in the morning. Just a little help. You can't start a fire. You can't start.
Dancing in the Dark, performed not by Bruce Springsteen this time, but by ProPublica workers picketing outside the investigative news outlet's Manhattan offices. The media workers have been fighting for over 2 years for their first union contract. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at how the Gulf states are reacting to the U.S.-Iran ceasefire. As negotiations are set to take place in Islamabad, Pakistan, Gulf states are expressing growing alarm that Iran will be allowed to maintain or even expand its control over the Strait of Hormuz. On Wednesday, the United Arab Emirates said it's seeking further clarification regarding Iran's commitment to the, quote, complete and unconditional reopening of the Strait of Hormuz, unquote. UAE officials have also said they want Iran to be held accountable for damages and to pay reparations for attacks on the UAE's energy facilities and infrastructure. During the war, Iran attacked all six Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. Several attacks were reported on Wednesday, even after the ceasefire was announced. We're joined now by Yasmin Farouk. She works at the International Crisis Group, where she serves as project director for the Gulf and Arabian Peninsula. Why don't you take us through the Gulf states and how they each individually have responded and as a group?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. Well, individually, you've seen mostly by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, but also Kuwait welcoming statements that welcome the ceasefire. But we have seen a welcome of the ceasefire that is conditioned on a long-term solution to their problems and the security threats that Iran represents to them, that it has shown during this war. And as you just mentioned in your introduction, really singling out the opening of the Strait of Hormuz as being one of the conditions that are not that they are not going to let go in the negotiations or whatever outcome comes from this war. The GCC also, which is the body that represents the six of them, also have welcomed the ceasefire, although the statement was very short, which shows that there isn't really total or identical views on this ceasefire, how it was achieved, and on the direction after. Oman, of course, was a country that welcomed the ceasefire, but this is coherent and consistent with its position not only when the war became very intense and we were getting into a phase where the war was going to get out of control, but since it began, Oman has kept the distance, and it was very consistent to be one of the first countries to welcome this ceasefire. Now, the countries that stand out are actually the UAE and Bahrain. As you just mentioned, the UAE statement was very detailed. It's a page-long statement, and it did not welcome the ceasefire. It said that it is following the ceasefire, and it fleshed out all the details that it expects from any negotiations that are coming after the ceasefire.
During this five-week period, Gulf states have been seeking to diversify security partnerships from European radar systems to anti-drone cooperation with Ukraine, you know, have learned to deal or have increased their expertise in dealing with Russia's drone strikes, which many of those drones came from Iran. How significant is it that these countries that once saw the U.S. as a security and military guarantor are now seeking alternative options?
So, first of all, this diversification has started since before. This is not the first time Iran targets those Gulf countries. Let's remember that the biggest attacks that have already pushed the Gulf countries to question how reliable and how satisfactory is the U.S. defense umbrella happened in 2019 and a couple of years afterwards when, of course, Iran denies its involvement in the 2019 attacks on Saudi Arabia and then on the Houthi attack on Abu Dhabi, in which Iranian technology, of course, has has been used. We have to also notice that in this reach out to countries in Asia, but also in Europe, to supply either batteries or even fighter jets with pilots in order to surveil the air, but also respond and intercept Iranian projectiles, have been done so far within the camp of U.S. allies. We have U.S. systems and British systems and European systems and Israeli systems in the Gulf. And so the Gulf diversification is still largely limited to U.S. allies. And reaching out to Ukraine is really what stands out in here. Of course, the Gulf countries had higher expectations in terms of military support from their European allies. But I see that the European involvement in this war and in the defense of their partners is already a first step that should be noted and I think will continue. We have read news today also that the Gulf countries are going to use some Chinese drones technology that already exists in Saudi Arabia and the UAE in defense. So this diversification that had started before will continue. But for the foreseeable future, the U.S. will be the backbone of defense in the GCC countries. And there is existing cooperation with Israel that, of course, also I see continuing.
On Tuesday, China and Russia vetoed a Bahrain-sponsored UN resolution that had strong U.S. and Gulf support. Can you talk about the significance of the veto, Yasmin, and what it means for the Gulf states to have their security determined by countries, again, that are not the United States?
So even a country like France and other European countries had issued with the first drafts of this resolution because it opened the door to the use of force to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, which is something that even the Europeans didn't want to be on board on. The UK, France, that took initiatives to reopen regarding the Strait of Hormuz were very clear that whatever action that will be taken is going to be taken after the war ends. Now, Bahrain has worked with the Security Council, and the UAE dispatched its own Minister of State to the Security Council to also help with that. And the veto at the end only came from Russia and China. I want to say that it was only half a surprise, if you want. China has not been up to the Gulf expectations in this crisis, in the sense that there was hope that have been, you know, given the Beijing process with Iran, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and given the OPEC Plus agreement with Russia and their position in the war on Ukraine, there were expectations that Russia and China's roles in this war are going to be different. So I think that this will also have an impact on the long-term relationship, particularly between a country like the UAE and Russia. As you know, the Abu Dhabi was a main venue for the negotiation between the U.S. and Russia, but also Ukraine and Russia. So it was a surprise, but it was only half a surprise given the role of those countries and their ties to Iran, including during this war.
We just have 30 seconds, Yasmin Farouk, but if you can just talk about what's at stake at this moment.
Well, first of all, as you said, one, the Strait of Hormuz, we have heard and seen actually very concerning remarks from President Trump saying that cooperation with Iran on a toll booth is something that is beautiful. This is something that will not be acceptable by the GCC countries. Also, if this war restarts, let's remember the ceasefire came at a moment when energy infrastructures, desalination, power plants, but nuclear plants could have been in the crossfire. So what is at stake here is an uncontrolled escalation that everyone wants to stop.
Yasmin Farouk is the Gulf and Arabian Peninsula Project Director at the International Crisis Group, speaking to us from the Gulf. That does it for our show. Juan Gonzalez is speaking today at 1 o'clock at the CUNY Grad Center in New York. We'll be tonight at the IFC Center for the theatrical release of the new film about Democracy Now!, Steal This Story, Please. It will be going through the weekend. We'll be doing Q&As with the director throughout next week. I'm Amy Goodman. This is another edition of Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
Looking for work that fits your schedule and can help make a difference in your community? Statistics Canada is hiring approximately 32,000 people across Canada for the 2026 census. Census jobs offer competitive pay, flexible hours, valuable experience, and the chance to help collect data that shape programs and services in your community. Apply today at census.gc.ca/jobs. A message from the Government of Canada.